Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is James Rosenfield with the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, Leadership, the Power Behind the Throne. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many program events held here at the club. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker tonight. Richard Heitner is the Deputy Chairman of Saatchi & Saatchi, in London. He's the Adjunct Associate Professor of Marketing at London Business School and the author of Consigliere, Leading from the Shadows. The book is for sale outside. It'll be for sale after, and I believe you'll be around to sign books. Is that terrific? Richard joined Saatchi in 2003 to lead Europe, Middle East, and Africa before becoming Deputy Chairman in 2006. In 2013, he also took on the global leadership of Saatchi & Saatchi S, whose purpose is to make irresistible brands sustainable and sustainability irresistible. He was made an Associate Adjunct Professor of Marketing at London Business School in August 2011, where he graduated as a Sloan Fellow in 2003. Richard is a trustee of Planting Promise, a sustainable education enterprise in Sierra Leone, and a trustee of the British Heart Foundation, chairing for 3 years its $50 million Mending Broken Hearts appeal. Beyond Manchester United, football, and family, Richard is a literature, theater, and film fanatic. I welcome Richard Heitner to the Commonwealth Club.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm delighted to be here. This is going to be as informal as you wish it to be. So whilst I have a number of thoughts I would like to share with you, the sooner we can get into a Q&A and into a hotly contested debate about the value of number twos and number ones, the better. So at any stage, feel free to raise your hand and say, that's quite enough of the formal proceedings. Let's get into questions and answers. On my way back from the gym last night, a man stalked me and said, I just have to ask you whether you are the percussionist of Paul McCartney. And I was briefly flattered. I thought, wow, that's amazing. And then I thought, but Paul McCartney's 72. And if he's the percussionist, isn't that Ringo Starr? And Ringo Starr's got hair. At which point I got mildly offended and thought I might deck this guy. Rather than do that, I paused and reflected and went to my room and emailed one of the people I interviewed for my book, Philip Norman, who is the acclaimed biographer of the Beatles and many other famous musicians. And I said, could it possibly be that I was mistaken for Paul McCartney's percussionist? And because I'm ready to go back to the gym tomorrow night and sort this man out. And he wrote back, and I was also worried, by the way, it could have been Charlie Watts, which would have been even worse. But he wrote back, and he said, no. I think he thought you were Elton John's percussionist, Ray Cooper, a man of some charm and education. So no need for any physical violence. And the reason I share this story is because, in effect, tonight's discussion is about the drummer. It's about the percussionist, not the preening lead singer. And it's about the seconds, the deputies, the assistants, the chiefs of staff, all those people who I think have been for far too long ignored by the academic fashion magazines and Wall Street, who continue to kind of play up the importance of the number one. So by signing up for this evening, I guess a few of you may have thought, second in command, that could be me. I hope I've got some seconds in the room. I know the radio listeners are not going to be able to enlighten me, but just a quick show of hands, how many people would say they're the out-and-out number one leaders of their organizations? I know we've got one or two in the room, because, yeah, okay, so a handful. Does that mean the rest of you are proud number twos? I can see a few nods. It's not a rhetorical question, maybe a few sitting on the fence. I'm going to put my position firmly in the room. I believe our current thinking around leadership is completely flawed. I don't think they're working. I don't think they're working either for those of us being led by the out-and-out leaders. I don't even believe it's working for the people who are leading. Certainly for those of us who are being led, the facts are that most bosses make us feel a little bit kind of underwhelmed. There's some recent work done by the Harvard Medical School that suggests, in fact, that bad bosses can make us more than feel underwhelmed. They can make us positively not well at all. Jonathan Quick, the doctor, talked about evidence being clear that despite the rationalization some leaders may use to defend their stress-inducing, unsupportive style. Such behaviour by leaders doesn't contribute to improved individual performance or organisational productivity. I quote in my book other data used by Julian Birkinshaw, a professor of London Business School, and he cites an economist, Richard Layard, who looked at how people like to spend their time. And he asked that question of a number of people: who would you like to spend most of your time with? And the majority, unsurprisingly, talked about friends and family. The last person people want to spend time with is the boss. So it's not surprising to learn that the bad boss, the abusive boss, can cause increases in blood pressure, stress, unhealthy behaviours such as smoking, excessive use of alcohol, and overeating. Those of us we're asking to lead aren't really that happy either, because if you think about what we're doing to our leaders these days, we're heaping unhealthy expectations on them. And then we're kind of rubbing our hands with glee when they fail to live up to those expectations. We're punishing them incredibly quickly. We kind of feign shock when they fail to deliver these ridiculous expectations. The roll call of rolling heads takes longer each year to read, as do the well-intentioned euphemisms for ritual sacrifice, like, we appreciate all Alan has done for us. He's been with us 4 months now. It's time he needs a fresh challenge. On Monday in Britain, London Business School hosted a debate with business leaders. It was to celebrate the respective birthdays, the 50th birthdays of London Business School itself, and the business section of the Sunday Times. And to celebrate that, they asked some prominent business leaders to debate whether Britain had been good for business. And the answer, despite five decades of boom and bust, was a pretty resounding yes. So it seems that in Britain, at least, we can survive damaging strikes, we could survive a three-day working week, we could survive a winter of discontent, we could survive more recently the ravaging effects of a recession, and still conclude we're a great place to do business. And yet the same people are reluctant to relinquish the cripplingly short horizons, time horizons, on which we judge CEOs in charge of really complex organisations. The average corner office now is inhabited for about 6 years, often vacated, in fact, before the pot plant even has time to bloom. I was talking to one of my colleagues, Jane Kendall, yesterday about Marissa Meyer and my shock, really, at the way that she's been treated. It was only 2 years ago that she was the darling of Yahoo. The stock price, at least the last time I looked yesterday, has tripled since she joined. But we're not happy. Investors aren't happy with Marissa Meyer because they'd like the company to be rescued by AOL. So, you know, Yahoo sucks to us, Yahoo sucks to Marissa Meyer. It feels quite shocking. This exactly the same fate is currently being endured by two of our leaders in the UK of our retail businesses. There's a guy called Mike Coop, who runs Sainsbury, a massive grocery retail store, and his fate now hangs in the balance after less than a year in the job. The same is true for a man called Dave Lewis, who was a very senior Unilever executive. He's called Drastic Dave, and Drastic Dave was brought in to turn around the ailing fortunes of the once great Tesco supermarket chain. He's been in post about 6 months, and already they've labelled him a little bit like sort of overripe tomatoes, beleaguered and embattled. They've kind of stamped a label on him. So we have this ridiculous situation where we crave the charismatic, the courageous, the heroic out-and-out leader, even as we recognise that leadership has always been, and even more so now, needs to be a collective endeavour. If you look at young people coming in who might one day aspire to lead some of our organisations, they look at the kind of hierarchy some of us have climbed, at least those of us in our mature years, and they look with some kind of shock and bemusement. We ask them, you know, this is the ladder that you might wish to climb, and they don't see the ladder. Millennials do not see a ladder. They see a whole host of job opportunities in their lifetime ahead of them. Again, London Business School data we've collected over 5 years suggests that, on average, a millennial, kind of 26 to 34-year-old something, will have about 16 jobs in their lifetime. That's double the number of jobs the generation prior. And if the trend data is kind of reliable, it means that our kids will have, on average, or your kids, on average, will have about 32 jobs in their lifetime. So this idea that we kind of, we're steady eddies and we climb a corporate ladder is kind of long gone. So net, and in short, I think the leadership model that we look at now is flawed, and we need a different kind of conversation about leadership. I think what is needed is a series of responsibilities, a series of relationships right across the organisation, where leadership is quite clearly not the sole preserve of the top dog, but where responsibilities are assigned much more carefully, probably much more frequently. I believe we need more bosses like my own, Kevin Roberts, who thought that I was not past my usefulness just because I didn't crave his job. I believe we need more leaders to value their leading cast members, the people who nodded and said they were proud number twos. I suspect are possibly undervalued even by the people who I interviewed and who in private would say, I would be nothing without these people. They're very happy to confess it in private and hugely reluctant to acknowledge it in public. We need many more leaders who are content to lead from beyond the number one position. I also think, by extension, we also need some people who are going to be courageous enough to step up and lead on our behalf and take those ultimate decisions. So if you're up for that, are we up for this?
Yes.
Shall we dig a little... Thank you very much, Gillian. How supportive. An LBS alum in the front row. We will dig a little deeper. Let's just talk a little bit then about this number one slot, because you will have studied leaders in the classroom. Many of you will have studied these out-and-out number one leaders, maybe on the school playing fields, maybe in the orchestra, on the stage. And maybe you'll have been quietly impressed by some of the leaders that you've witnessed, people who've taken their responsibilities lightly, worn them well, and not allowed hubris to kind of overtake them. You may also have witnessed some pretty appalling behavior, probably alpha male, almost certainly testosterone-fueled, and you will look at these people with horror. And I have to confess, when I started to research my book and when I thought about writing a book, I did it more in anger than in admiration. And I thought it was time to take the game to these rather hubristic, excessively narcissistic leaders and put the record straight. And I was pretty angry at the time, not with my own boss, I have to say, if this is being broadcast, but with bosses generally. It was actually quite a therapeutic exercise, because in truth, I think there are reasons why some bosses can disappoint. I think, on reflection, I think we need to show these kind of people more appreciation. I think we need to show them more forgiveness, because we do heap ridiculous expectations on their shoulders. It was interesting, because I found people's appetite to forgive far deeper than my own when I interviewed a lot of number twos, threes, fours, whatever we come on to call them. But they also were pretty revealing about some bad boss behavior. So I thought, maybe as a test, I might ask you, without naming names, and I don't know where you work, so you're safe, and this is radio, not TV, I might ask for a show of hands about whether you have ever come across a boss, ever, who set you a challenge and on purpose starved you of the time, the resources, the money and the support you needed to succeed. Thank you very much. For those listening in, that was a pretty fine showing of hands. Sad to say, there were people here from Saatchi who put their hands up, so it's going to be a very short evening. How about a boss who set you a challenge well within your capability and then micromanaged you almost to destruction? Without his interference in every tiny step, you could have made that thing happen in half the time with none of the pain. Yep, plenty of those. What about this? The boss who was clueless what to do until you gave him your winning idea, only to hear that boss then go on and present that idea as his own, scoop up and hoover up every crumb of credit, not a jot of recognition for you, all the recognition to him, or her, to be fair. I myself have had a boss who told me he doesn't do bad news because it depresses him. Just the kind of boss who Mary Barra is kind of sweeping up for at GM. You create a don't bring me bad news culture and you create all sorts of trouble. So open up the papers almost every day and there's a boss somewhere in somebody's bad books. The Secret Service, as you know well here, has had its fair share of bosses who've taken a bad rap from those who work for them. This in the Washington Post only last month about Julia Pearson's resignation. Officers in charge of protecting the White House say they've grown resentful at being belittled by their bosses and routinely forced to work on off days. Some agents who've sworn to take a bullet for the president and his family
have little faith in the wisdom or direction of their senior most leaders. But I'm not here to fuel dissatisfaction with the top dogs. Why would I, when I've already seen two or three of you say you are the top bananas, and when I've already said that I need others of you, clearly, and we need others of you, to be those top bananas? I think what I would love to do is try to explain at least some of the insight I got about what drives this behaviour and why our out-and-out leaders, our A's as we call them, sometimes lose the plot. And my sympathy extends to those who had ridiculous expectations heaped on them at that first smack at birth. You know, look at the lungs on her. I wonder what she's going to do. Or those of us who had so much praise or denied any praise that as we progressed through school, there was only one option. There was only King Lear that we could possibly play in King Lear. If it wasn't the king, it couldn't be anybody else. Hamlet in Hamlet, or Don't Bother Casting Me, or Antony and Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra. In Ben Ainslie's case, he's a serial British Olympic rowing champion. He confessed to an inability to countenance coming second, driven by a need to overcome teasing at school about a skin condition he had. I asked Carlo Santalbano, who was interim chairman of Cushman & Wakefield globally and still chief executive of its European, Middle East and African operations, at what moment did he decide he had to be a number one? And he didn't miss a beat. He said, when I realised I couldn't possibly be a number two. So if you've never felt that urge to stride to the front, maybe you didn't suffer some kind of traumatic pain in your childhood. Maybe your parents' ambition for you wasn't so outlandish that you weren't driven to kind of stretch yourself to be that number one. It's also worth saying that many of those leaders that we take a look at now were reluctant leaders in the first place. They didn't vote to be that number one. We asked them to do that. They were genuinely reluctant leaders, stepping in to sort out a problem, like Joseph Clancy's done at the Secret Service, brought out of retirement. Many people who just never wanted to be that person, but we asked them to do it, and they stepped up and did a good job or not. So we can never know what drives these crazies on to take the top job. Two of the most impressive people, I have to say, I interviewed were two ladies, both at the time operating as chief executives in the UK. One lady called Amanda Blank, who is still chief exec of the AXA UK business, and another lady, Anna Botine, who's probably better known in America. She's now the chairwoman of Grupo Santander, a Forbes 50 company. And Blank, Amanda, she disarms with her candor about her number one moments. She said it occurred to her when she was four that she needed to be the number one. And she quotes a thing called anniversary. She comes from Wales, and in Wales they had a thing at school called the anniversary, which is like a Sunday school concert. And as she describes it, she was the narrator, she was the singer, she was the person that played the piano. I loved being that person. I didn't want to be the person in the group. I had to be the person singing on my own. So if on occasion somebody actually suggested she had to sing in a group, she would be, you've got to be kidding. I can't possibly be that person. And even now, if you ask the people at AXA about Amanda, they know she's their out-and-out leader. And they admire her, and they even adore her for the fact that she will take the bullet before anybody else. And it's that kind of willingness to be finally accountable that I think those of us who've either done the job and hated it, or done the job and wanted to move on, or those of us who never want to do that, we sometimes underestimate quite how ugly that final accountability can be. Anna Patricia Botine, who's as well-balanced a leader as I think I've ever worked with, talked about being averse to playing any role other than the out-and-out leader. She quoted a phrase from Spanish. She said, in Spanish, there's a saying, I'd rather be the head of a mouse than the tail of a lion. Now, as it happens for Anna, she's ended up being the head of a line, now this huge group on the sad death of her father. But it's that kind of self-awareness, that appetite to lead, that healthy self-awareness that says, I have to be that person, that I think we should appreciate and celebrate, because it's a visible, really transparent statement she's making there. And I don't believe many of us are willing to take those kind of tough daily decisions. So I think that's more than enough on the firsts. I believe they are the kind of people that take risks. They're the people who are prepared to step up. They grasp situations quickly, and I think they deserve our appreciation. We've got to end our unhealthy obsession with failure. We love it, and I don't know why. I think the media and popular culture has exacerbated our desire to kind of give people an instant thumbs up, an instant thumbs down. That's what TV shows do these days. And we somehow love to kind of tell stories of people who didn't make it. And I could give you endless examples, but I'm shocked again, putting party politics aside, how President Obama can be, you know, light of the world 1 minute and not that many years later, lame duck. It makes no sense to me. And I know there's something kind of endemic in the institution and the structure that's kind of in some way explains that. But there's also something I think particularly distasteful about the way societies all over the world build up their leaders only to then knock them down. So, to all you leaders out there, you A leaders, I think this esteemed gathering, at least I hope now, in years to come, will hope that you lead us to bigger and better places, that you lead bigger and better organizations, and that applauding your performances and gasping in admiration and following you on Twitter is merely a list of minor inconveniences given the slice of the organization stress that you're willing to consume. And by now, I'm sure the A's in the room, and there weren't many of you, but those of you here must be glowing and your heads are swelling and it's all looking marvelous. At which point, I just remind you of Carly Simon's lyric that you're so vain, and you'd better think again. Because, as is sung in the school playground, at least in Britain, first the worst, second the best, third the one with the hairy chest. So we've dealt with the first. We're not dealing with the chest, so we're going to come to the best, and that's the second. The second's in command. And you may or may not recall those fans of you who love The Godfather. You may remember the way the consigliere is introduced. It's actually Michael Corleone who's explaining to his fiancée who this character is. And he says he's Tom Hagen, and he's going to be the consigliere. And she says, what's a consigliere? And he says, well, he's the family lawyer. You know, he's not Sicilian, but he's good. And I think that kind of sums it up, really, because in many ways, he's the perfect model. It's the fact that he's not Sicilian. He's Irish. That means he can never be the Don. He, therefore, is completely trustworthy because he doesn't have any of that kind of naked ambition closeted away that one day will give him the throne. And when you look, and I did look at the number of people who operate in this kind of broad consigliere role, I've kind of taken a liberty with consigliere and broadened it from being simply just, you know, advisor to an illegitimate family organization to something a little bit more broad, to encompass those of us who might act as strategy directors, HR directors, functional assistants, deputies, assistants, lots of different roles. You might have anybody from a whole roll call of people, whether it's Alistair Campbell, who was the press communications guy for Tony Blair, now David Axelrod, who we shipped in from Barack Obama and gave to Ed Miliband. I don't think he's doing that good a job, but we'll come to that. Any one of Cheney, Rumsfeld, or Rove to George Bush, Harry Hopkins to FDR, Valerie Jarrett now, the third Obama, Amit Shah to Narendra Modi, any number of people to Tim Cook now. I mean, obviously Tim Cook once upon a time to Steve Jobs, but now Dr. Dre from Beats, Angela Ahrens. You could name, obviously, Jonathan Ive, and a number of people who operate in some kind of consigliere role to Tim Cook. These are leaders, in my view, in their own right. So I call them C leaders, consigliere leaders, but the critical thing is they are leaders, and they are not people who are in some way less than equal than the number one. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we have this horrible attachment to numbers. Number ones, number twos. And you know perfectly well if you say of somebody, he's a great number two, that there's a coded message there that actually he's a lousy number one. It's not that kind of compliment and ringing endorsement of your talents to hear somebody say he's a great number two. And it really confuses me that these people have had so little attention, certainly in what's written academically on leadership and often what's written publicly all the time about leaders. Because whilst it is true the A leaders, these people I talked about first, absolutely create the purpose, they choose the team, they set the standard, they make the tough decisions, these C leaders, at their best, take that vision. They first of all help co-create it, shape it. They then live it. They often choose the A, if not manipulatively. They actually make an active choice of A they're going to serve. They then also collaborate with the rest of the team. They very much influence that team, and quite often they fix the aftermath of the decisions the A is making. So whilst they have overtly less authority, there are a great many attributes and virtues to being this number two, or the C as I call them. You get more time to think. You get more time to shape. You must have more time to help other people land their best ideas, which the out-and-out leader rarely has the opportunity to do. You get a great buzz from the proximity to power without having to be the final exerciser of that power. And yet we do have this weirdly dispiriting relationship with hierarchy that means we don't celebrate these people as much as we should. So I think we should say no to the numbers. I did consider very briefly looking as an inspiration for my book at field biology. Some very clever field biologists actually worked out that the beta baboon is a lot more happy and endures a lot less stress than the alpha baboon. But the publisher turned down baboon leadership as a working title. And instead, I was encouraged to work with this idea of A and C leaders and consiglieri. And this A and C idea basically assigns very clear responsibilities to A kind of leaders and C kind of leaders. It's a system designed to reduce the cult of that out-and-out leader and that sole preserve of the leader. And it's designed to celebrate and promote this idea of a diverse set of C leaders. Smart A's will have more than one C. And like a packet of confectionery, they may all be coated with the same chocolate flavour. We all work for the same organisation. We all sign up to the same cause. But each of these confectionery, revels, as we call them in the UK, there's a different centre to them. And that's what a great circle of consiglieri should be like. And when A's look in the mirror, they should be able to see that circle kind of played back to them. So in my own boss's case, in Kevin Roberts' case, were he ever to look in the mirror, I'm sure he's not vain enough to do that, he might see his worldwide CFO, Bill Cochran. He would certainly see his worldwide HR director, Milano Reyna. He'd see his head of strategy, Vaughan Emsley. If on tiptoes, he might see a little glimpse of me. Behind me, he might see my own consigliora, Jane Kendall, over there. He would certainly see his PA in New Zealand, Julie Hart. And almost certainly, he would see his own boss, Maurice Levy, at Publicis Group, because he goes to him occasionally for counsel. So this isn't a kind of very fixed system. This is a system that says, at different points of your day, at different times of your life, you may well be A or C or both. And indeed, many of us, even though many of you said you are largely C's, in that role, you will almost certainly have people looking up to you as their A. You might be running a team and advising somebody else. And I think, in truth, statistically, most bosses have bosses. So even the great A's, even my own big boss, has a big boss who has a big boss. And again, he won't like me saying that on radio, but it's true. So how many people, when they look in the mirror as A's, see their spouses or partners? I know we have some here, and I'm happy to see that. But my research suggests that very few A leaders use their spouses or partners as their critical C's, as their critical friends. It amazes me. I would be literally nowhere without mine having played a pretty strong C role in my professional life, at least. And I think the First Lady is a great place to look, and it may become something completely different if Hillary chooses to run. But if you look at the role Dennis Thatcher played for Margaret Thatcher, he was derided in the British press for being a man of no great intellect. But I think his rock-solid support at home for Margaret Thatcher enabled her to do what she did. Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, is probably the first political example of a really high-profile, significant First Lady. I was discussing this with a professor of politics at Oxford University, a guy called Archie Brown, whose book you should buy after mine. It's called The Myth of the Strong Leader. The Myth of the Strong Leader, I recommend it. It's an amazing book. And he, again, is looking at the kind of the ludicrousness of the heroic leader alone and goes back in history to track seismic events and whether you can really attribute them to one single person or whether you can attribute them to a collective. And he has some great examples. He gave me a wonderful example about Raisa Gorbachev and her role supporting Mikhail Gorbachev. And he tells this story, or told me to look up the story, of how Mikhail Gorbachev's intensely close partnership represented a total break with Soviet practice, because Raisi used to accompany him on all visits, both to the Russian provinces and on all trips. It caused a sensation at the time in the Soviet Union. He was interviewed on NBC by a guy called Tom Brokaw. Would you pronounce it? Brokaw. Thank you, Brokaw. And he was asked what issues he discussed with his wife. And Gorbachev's answer was, "We discuss everything." That was it. And it caused an absolute sensation on Soviet TV and radio, published in Pravda, the lot. And Brokaw's follow-up question and Gorbachev's answer was too much even for the changing Soviet mass media. He inquired, including Soviet affairs at the highest level, Mr. Gorbachev, to which Gorbachev responded, "I think I've answered your question. We discuss everything." So C leaders are not those who've simply escaped the horrors of the A leadership. I just want to talk very briefly about that. Then I'm going to open it up for questions. Because quite often in the talks and the discussions, great conversations I've had with people since publishing the book, a lot of people talk about, well, what's really the driving motivation for being a C, and why did you do it? Why did you give up being the chief executive of Saatchi in Europe, and why have you taken this job as an also-ran? And the truth is, in my own specific example, I did it in part to escape the horrors of being an A. And there's no hiding that at a certain time in your life you realize whether you do get really motivated by the challenge of finding an extra margin point of profit, or in leading vast numbers of people, or having a slightly bigger office. But in my own case, those decisions started to weigh more heavily, and I desperately wanted to feel more liberated from that. And having spent a year at London Business School 3 years prior, I'd enjoyed not having the status, not having the PA next to me, not having all of that stuff. And I kind of hankered for more of that. And there are other great people, by the way, or other people that I look to who've kind of commented on the horrors of the A position and why that number two position is so much better. I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up in my hotel room a book on Jefferson. Amazingly, he had this to say about being the vice president and the president. He said, "The second office of this government is honorable and easy. The first is but a splendid misery." And then later in his life, having been the president, "Never did a prisoner released from his chains feel such relief as I shall on shaking off the shackles of power." So there is something very liberating about that. Robert Gates, in his new memoir, says the challenge for historians and journalists and memoirists is how to convey the crushing effect of dealing daily with multiple problems, pivoting on a dime every few minutes from one issue to another, having to quickly absorb reporting from many different sources on each problem, and then making decisions, always with too little time and too much ambiguous information. So, of course, there's an escape. But the truth is, if you're going to be a major C, you're still going to be heavily accountable for something. The great Cs do not duck accountability. They absolutely want lots of responsibility. And there are much more powerful motivations at play, and maybe we'll get into some of those during the debate. Some of those motivations I found from my interviewees included things like much more control over one's agenda. So that's a very basic idea that if you're a C, even though you might well be working at times 24/7, you are heavily accountable. There is something slightly more controllable about how you can shape your agenda. A man who worked for Ana Botín at Santander called José María Nuss, who his Spanish friends rather call initially il professore and then il consigliere, he said, "I love a good lunch, but I'm no good with a good lunch and a good dinner." That was how he explained kind of his attitude to his workload and needing more time. A lady called Gayatri Kashri, who was the fifth kind of foxhound in the Madoff affair, and a brilliant lawyer in her own right, she now has her own legal practice, and she talked about the C role giving you much more time for self-reflection. A's are not that good at self-reflection. They feel it's kind of a softies work to think about yourself and what you might need in your life. This is, you know, we've got decisions to make here. Whereas Cs actually are allowed to spend time with self-reflection. Clearly, one's ability to influence an A with whom you feel a strong kind of common bond, for whom you might feel some deep affection, wanting to influence that A for positive outcomes is a big motivation. A rather large chap called Bruno De Michelis, who was a fantastic sports psychologist, first discovered by an Italian football manager called Carlo Ancelotti, followed Carlo Ancelotti from AC Milan to Chelsea Football Club. And I met Big Bruno, as he's called. He's an ex-Olympian, an ex-martial arts expert, huge. And he was described as Carlo Ancelotti's best business when he came to Chelsea, because Bruno set up the mind room at AC Milan, at the Milanello. He's the guy that actually taught the footballers to start thinking about what goes on up there as opposed to just their craft skills. And I asked him, you know, you've worked now for three great football coaches. Has it never occurred to you you could be the A? You could be the guy? And he said, I'd never do that. I just go out and find an A who will impose my will. And that's some kind of C. And when I asked him how to describe his strengths, he talked about vision and tenacity and all the kind of A traits that you think about. And yet he's absolutely a C. He's a craft expert. He's a mind expert. He just knows what he wants. So there's that too. And then you get this kind of extraordinary access and a front row seat. David Nussbaum, who was chairman of Transparency International, I asked him, you know, what's it like now being a chairman, not a chief executive? And he said, well, the thing is, I'm fine with not being a chief executive as long as I get a seat at the table. It doesn't have to be the head of the table, but I want a seat at the table. Last week, there's a new film coming out about Muhammad Ali, and I picked up a wonderful piece about a guy called Gene Kilroy, who was one of his famous seconds. In fact, he was the second who was first into the ring when Muhammad Ali regained his world heavyweight title in his Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman. And the article quoted Kilroy as saying, "Nothing will ever take my memories away of being with Ali. His voice momentarily cracking," it said. "Millionaires and billionaires would pay their fortune to have done what I did. When I was with Ali, I sat with kings, presidents, emperors, and queens. You can't imagine the fun we had. Nothing could compare. I lived it. I was blessed. If I was to die and go to heaven, it would be a step down." I don't know how many of you feel that about your A's, but that's clearly what's going on. So I think that's kind of all I wanted to say by way of setup. I've got more I could share with you about what qualities the A's look for from their C's, and we might get into that in the discussion. But I think what I would like to do is just land this idea that A's, I think, need to be appreciated. They need to be forgiven. They don't set out to be bad A's. We, in part, are responsible for them becoming bad A's. And there's something rather kind of inevitable about the seeds of their own destruction being kind of sown into their employment contracts, particularly if they stay around too long in the same job. But we need them. I truly believe we need them. I'm not up for that kind of Zappos holocracy where everybody takes every decision. No offense to anybody at Zappos. And I'll take some heat from that, from those who wish to give it. But I'm not up for that. I do believe teams need to be equipped with a team decider. That does not mean the decider rules the roost. At the same time, I believe passionately that there is great joy to be had in being a consigliere of a sort. There are many different kinds, and I can talk about the kind of roles and the role models for those, again, in more questions. But more than anything, I think what I would love to see is a new conversation about the relationship between the two. The relationship between A and C, the relationship between C's and other C's, and the way we construct our teams to better lead the kind of organisations and causes we care about. So on that note, I think that's more than enough formal chat. I will step down from this, and you probably know I'm on that kind of little stand, which is rather depressing. So as I step down, I will sit down and take some questions and debate, and thank you very much.
Please, I just want to remind our radio audience, that here at the Commonwealth Club, we're listening to Richard Leitner, who just gave us a... I'm sorry.
But it is a light version, Richard Leitner.
Richard Heitner. We got his light talk. Thank you for that. And he's speaking about his book, Consigliere, Leading from the Shadows. We have another microphone, so please use the microphone for your questions so it is recorded. We'll pass that around.
Thank you. Yes, so we have a question from the front.
My name is Michael Burkett, and I'm a freelance journalist currently on assignment with the Guardsman City College of San Francisco's newspaper. I am not reporting on them to them for this, though. My question, Joe Keefe of Pax Worldwide Investments came and spoke at the Commonwealth Club, and he made the point that the boards and the organizations that have women on the board tend to be much stronger than those. And one of the things that he mentioned was a columnist on the New York Times, and unfortunately I don't have my notes and his name escapes me, talked about the world financial crisis, which is a recession and all that stuff and everything. And he said, wouldn't it have been better if it had been Lehman Sisters? And he said, no, it would have been much better if it had been Lehman Brothers and Sisters. And also looking back at the history of business in the United States, I looked at how Martha Stewart, the second she became successful, she was put in jail. Leona Helmsley became very successful, and she was put in jail. And the list goes on and on. Hillary Clinton was lambasted for being the Secretary of State. Those women who have broken and that glass ceiling in whatever form that they are, and that seems to be, to me, you talk about the consigliarities and the way that we do business and everything. To me, the male-dominated structure that we have, the patriarchal society, seems to be that. Is that something that you share too?
Thank you for that. I think that's a great observation. I found it fascinating, this male-female thing. I didn't set out to discover anything particular about that. I simply wanted to talk about the importance of a diverse set of consiglieri. What I have found and unearthed are several things. Number one, women have responded to the idea of this warmly for two reasons. One, it credits those who've been playing this kind of role really more visibly and more vocally than the credit they've had thus far for being great influencers, great shapers, and more importantly, great leaders. I believe it's a leadership function, this. And I do think a lot of women who've done this kind of role remarkably well have not been credited with the kind of recognition they deserve. So in part, it's had a warm response for women for that reason. But there's another reason, which is, wouldn't it be fantastic if this really did land with men? And more men opted for these roles, because then they could clear out the way from the A roles to which they're eminently not suited, so that more women could take those A roles. So if it really works, the right people will get the A jobs and the right people will get the C jobs. I do think, just as an aside, that you've touched on a fair observation, that when the women do make those A jobs, and more of them do now, we perhaps apply a different kind of standard to them. I wonder if Marissa Meyer is getting a particularly bad press at Yahoo, whether a guy who'd gone in there and got that kind of investment back from Alibaba and made all those kind of bets with acquisitions and was still returning shareholder value to the tune that she is, I wonder whether she would get the same bad, he would get the same bad rap that she is. Virginia Romity, Mary Barra, they're all kind of, you know, the stakes are high. I don't know if they're higher, I don't know if that's scientific, but I think it's a fair shout. It's a fair observation. Yeah.
Hi, Richard. I'm Prabha, a second-year MBA at London Business School. Thank you, first of all, for an exhilarating jaunt through the landscape of leaders and their supporting cast. My question is this. Isn't part of the issue that quite often the best stepping stone to becoming number one is being number two? So if we want to attribute independent value to the number twos, are you saying that we should reroute CEOs' paths to power? And how do we do that without losing that valuable training ground that often comes with being number two first?
Yeah, I think great number ones have been great number twos. I think the really best chief executives now, it may always have been the case, but great ones now have learnt the art of persuasion and influence. They've learned to make things happen without the overt authority to make them happen. It makes them more empathetic. It makes them better leaders. So there are a number of ways you kind of make it to the A position, either by being a serial A throughout one's kind of career opportunities, or by, as you say, practicing being a functional number two. I believe the answer is to give people, particularly younger people, aspiring leaders, more conscious opportunities to develop both different leadership muscles. I think the complete leaders know how to do both. That's why I think it's very healthy for people to be both A and C. What I've observed in my own working life is that even though we have a bias to one rather than the other, typically what happens is we'll have somebody in an A position, and where we need them to be a C, and we need them to consciously be a C, they're lousy at it, and we kind of let them off the hook because, well, he's just a serial A. That's just who. That's the kind of person he is. Put up with it. And I think it's unacceptable. I think great leaders need to learn how to be both a C and an A. So my answer to your question is, no, I'm not asking for a rerouting. I am asking for more conscious, deliberate choices to be made, both by the aspiring leader and people who are giving those leaders those opportunities, and testing them in different kind of projects. It's more than possible to construct a kind of job for somebody on a shorter term basis than we allow people to do. At the moment, we're more likely to go, well, he wants to be an A, so send him off to Poland, and because Poland's not strategic for us right now, let him fail in Poland. That's an outrageous thing to do. You know, give the guy a chance.
Hello, my name is John Brigginshaw. Do you ever feel, although we know that you say this is always done too quickly, but do you ever feel that just for the good of the organization, it's necessary for the C leader to knife the A? And how would you approach that?
No. I think the CEO gets knifed by the board. And the board is institutionally and structurally there to make sure that the executives live up to standards and live up to the delivery of the vision they've agreed with their board. So in that sense, the executive chairman, as the C, often does have to plunge the knife into the A, for sure. What do you do if you're a C and your A behaves really badly, and you haven't read chapter 6 and 7 of my book, and you don't know how to get that A back on the road? I think you have a stark choice, and it's get yourself a new A elsewhere. I think one has to proceed very carefully with the idea of, you know, kingmaker, and, you know, we're not happy with you, in goes the knife, and let's find somebody else. Everybody's worried now because we're talking about daggers and knives.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'll take a step back. The question I have is around, is it different from country to country? Mm-hmm. So at one level, I look at American magazines and the amount of CEOs, you know, Fortune magazine or Forbes or whatever, they love putting a CEO on the cover. And a magazine like The Economist would never do it, for example. But then you mentioned Modi in India, and you think of a bunch of countries. So is there something inherently human in just lionizing the leader and diminishing his supporting cast?
Well, we are fascinated by that front cover. And America, you're right, loves nothing more than the CEO of the month. And but that's common in quite a few countries. The exception I found in my research was in Asia, where, although it's changing quite rapidly, there is more honour, natural honour, to be had in playing a second position, because it's inherent in the culture that you're there to serve some kind of higher order, authority or purpose. But even there it's changing, and even there I think there is a feeling that the A's can be abusive. So I think the idea is universal. It does have shades, you're so right about that, and there is a particular fixation with the kind of the model CEO on certain magazine front covers in certain countries. I think that's fair. We've got one over here. Thank you. This is a terrifying moment because this is Annie Longsworth, who is working at Saatchi & Saatchi, and technically I'm her A, so this
yes.
could be interesting.
I will ask as your C. I'm curious about your thoughts on happiness when it comes to leadership, because there's a sense, too, that if you are an A, you're not allowed to be happy in that role. And if you do anything like take a vacation or spend time with your children, that sort of is taking away from your ability to be a leader. And yet, I think the role of happiness in our lives is becoming a more and more important conversation. So I'm just curious, do you think there's a difference when it comes to happiness in an A or a C or not?
Yeah. I think what's interesting about A's, that the really committed lifelong A's are unable to be as happy, I think, as C's. And here's why. Because what makes them so good as A's makes them continually restless and dissatisfied with what they've got. So when I think of some of the A's that I've observed, even at a distance, Sir Alex Ferguson, who's the great A of Manchester United, my football club from the UK, who led Manchester United to glory over a course of 25 years, could never be happy. He could never enjoy any trophy beyond the 5 minutes in which that trophy was lifted, because he was always worried about what was going to happen next. So there is a kind of Tantalus restlessness about great A's that means they can't be happy. That's one of the reasons they get my sympathy. That said, I think it's outrageous the way we treat A's and expect them never to have a break. That makes them lesser A's. I think A's need a break like everybody else. I, again, was somewhat scandalized by the way that Obama gets, you know, literally abused for going and having a round of golf. You know, maybe it's really, really healthy for our president to get a round of golf. Maybe it's even healthier for him to get his advice from a caddy on what he should do next, because at least he's listening. Again, that's not party political. And I know he quite likes his golf and he has quite a few rounds, but that's not the point. We need our A's to be less fatigued. Tony Blair, I have to tell you, knows how to look after his own well-being. I talked to a lot of Tony Blair's circle, Alistair Campbell in particular. He quoted the Prince of Darkness, Peter Mandelson, who was known as the Third Man. And Peter Mandelson said of Tony Blair, "The thing that I find utterly delicious about Tony Blair is his absolute selfishness. He could go to bed at 7 o'clock in the evening and leave an entire team working through the night on his speech, and get up the next morning, wander in his dressing gown and say, 'You all look so tired. What's wrong with you?'" You know, so I think, so one answer is A's, of course, are entitled to breaks. We need them to. But I think inherent within the life of an A is a certain degree of dissatisfaction. A C, on the other hand, can only be truly content if he or she is willing to give up an awful lot. And it's worth saying that, you know, the life of a C is full of compromise and sacrifice. You give up status, you give up money, you give up authority, you give up a hell of a lot. And when I first agreed I was going to be a deputy chairman, although there's no forum, by the way, in which I deputise for anybody, but deputy chairman is what I am, I went to see the chairman, for whom I don't actually deputise, Bob Salert, and I said, "Any counsel?" And he said, "Well, it's great. I think this is really going to suit you. I think you're going to enjoy it. But just to be really, really clear, we're never going to pay you as much money as if you carried on being an A." So it's there it is. There's your transaction, and you live with it or you don't. And obviously, as I've said, C's and A's exist right throughout the organization. But I think the truly happy C is someone who's prepared to give up an awful lot. Got another one from our friend the reporter here. This is beginning to worry me.
Again, Michael Burkett, freelance journalist. Joe Keith made the observation, and you talked about it a very, very small amount, was the collaboration, and he made the observation that men tend to put their business life over here and their personal life over here, and women tend to put their personal life and their business life in the same sock, and also to collaborate. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to loudly agree with that. It's, of course, a sweeping generalization. I do know some men who are far better at integrating and blending work and life, and who've found some kind of balance, whether as an A or a C. So it's possible. But certainly, again, going back to the research for my book, I noticed more women were prepared to talk to their spouses at home about their work without any kind of overt agenda. Amanda Blank, I mentioned, she has an unusual setup because she and her husband, she's this big A at AXA, and Ken looks after the family and works from home. But every night she comes home, they have a formal debrief of their day, which is remarkable. 45 minutes, 22 and a half minutes each, where she runs through her day and he coaches her, and then they do the reverse. It's a kind of, you know, a download, a dance of a download. I think it's lovely. Now, that's probably too formal for some, but I think it's very healthy. And it, particularly if you formally assigned that C role to your spouse at home, you know, if you're giving them permission. I give my wife permission to tell me when I'm misbehaving, and the mantra at home, my boss is called Kevin Roberts, and every time I squeak and I get angry, you know, the mantra is, to be fair to Kevin. That's all I hear my wife say, to be fair to Kevin. It drives me nuts. But had she not done that, I'd be in all sorts of trouble. So it's important. Did I have a question at the back? Or?
I have one.
Yes.
You made reference to the president's golf caddy and have referred to spouses several times. The informalcy. Do you have more insights about the informalcy? Those, the driver, the...
Yeah.
Where they come from, what
yeah.
role they have,
it's
and the importance.
Yeah, I mean, there are four types of seat, because, of course, these books have to have very clear types. And so I've got four kind of types as vessels for all sorts of different role models. But the first one, the lodestone, which is the person that liberates their leader, is typically an amazing PA, EA, chief of staff. They call them turtles at BP. They can be roadies in a band. They can be caddies in golf. The kind of people who you think, oh, okay, well, they schlep the bags or they get my kit ready so that I can perform. That's their function. But they have disproportionate value. And there are great stories about, you know, the roadie for the Beatles, Neil Aspinall, who ended up running the Apple Company. There is a story of a caddy, Alfie Files, who caddied for Tom Watson during the famous Duel in the Sun. It was Alfie Files who told Tom Watson to use a 7-iron, not a 6-iron, because his adrenaline was pumping. You know, so there are people in those kind of roles. The corner man, I mentioned the second, Gene Kilroy, but there are others. You know, Angelo Dundee, who famously said to Sugar Ray Leonard, "You're blowing it, son. You're blowing it." You know, people who will give you that advice, who know what you can take, who know the decisions you're prepared to live with, and what effect they'll have on you. These are very important, critical friends. Some wonderful, wonderful role models for that in literature. Anybody who loves their Shakespeare will know the fool. You know, the fool is the fool, but some of the best advice comes from the fool. And the use of humor to kind of choose your moment when you're going to give that leader the real unvarnished truth. These are critical, critical roles for a consigliere.
And I'm curious if you talked to anybody in organized religion when you were doing your study, and then also, what do you think? How would you interpret Pope Francis's popularity in terms of, would it be that he's a C acting in the role of an A?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, first of all, no to the first question, and I wish I had now because I'd be able to answer the second. what an extraordinary guy he is. I think he's a kind of institutional C, but clearly out there in front as an iconic A, but I think his gifts are more C-like in their extraordinary empathy he has with people. And I've not witnessed anyway him being kind of dogmatic or dictatorial in his approach. What do you think? I mean, I know you're a student of religion. I'd like to hear from you.
Well, I think part of his success is just the surprise of him leading as a leader in a different way.
Yeah.
And if his predecessors had been C's and he all of a sudden was an A, he also may have success, and you know, timing may be a very important factor in whether an organization needs an A or a C.
Yeah. Listeners got the better answer there, so that's good. We had one here, did we? Did you have one? He changed his mind. Okay.
There's some thinking that we're moving into a purpose economy, where business is driven by making a difference. And this is underwritten by the purpose generation, where people, young people coming out of college are looking for jobs that offer them an opportunity to make a difference rather than title or money. Could this movement perhaps be a float upon which seconds can rise to a level that might be more accepted and more recognized?
I really hope so. I too am a purpose junkie. I think great Cs are often the architects of great purpose because, as I said, I think Cs in a particular kind of function have the time to think. They have the time to convene groups to and to help the A alight on a really great purpose. So number one, I think the C role is often a great place from which to co-author some kind of purpose for a cause and organization. That's number one. Number two, I think you're so right that people coming into this purpose economy are simply not as attracted to the things that motivated people of my generation when we joined organizations with an aspiration to lead. They're looking for very different things. They're looking, as you say, for belonging to a cause, belonging to something that means more to them than simply money or title. They're looking for the importance of the work they're going to do, the impact they're going to have. And so I think it of course means that there's going to be more work for, more important work to be done by people in a C position. So yes, I hope it works to that, you know, to that trend. It should do. There's no question that the millennials have so much less interest in some of the more traditional, conventional hierarchies and power dynamics that have fueled many organizations. That they are looking for something profoundly different. And thank goodness that they are. No, just thank you very much for your observations. It's been an absolute delight. And I will, if you would like to, be signing books at the back, but I don't want people to feel under any pressure to do that. Thank you very much.
Once again, I want to thank Richard Heitner for his comments today. That was lovely. We also want to thank our audience here at the club as well as our radio audience. There are books for sale outside. Renee will help you. Please do. I can't wait to read it myself. And Richard will be here to sign them. Thank you for coming. Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.